Who is the absolute?
But how do we understand Janadya se yatahat? Based on which Upanishad it yatahat? We say that that means that it is the absolute truth is the Janma. Adi means creation, maintenance, and destruction. It's from Taittiriya Upanishad. The Yatovaim, this is quoted in Prabhupada's books also. Yatovaim ani bhutani jayante, yena jatani jayante, yat yat vishin vishinti, tad vijigyasasta, tad brahmeti. So this brings the two. We have the atato brahma jignyasa. Now we should inquire into the absolute. So this is stated in the Taittiriya Upanishad, just as well. Tad vijyagyasasva. This is the proper subject of inquiry. And then the next sutra of Vedanta Sutra, Brahma Sutra, is janmadhyasyatyasaha, the absolute. Janma adi here is understood to mean, janma means here creation. And then adi means etc. So, or beginning with, so it means creation, maintenance, and destruction. So, tad vijyagyasasva, tad brahmeti. This is the proper subject of inquiry. This is Brahma. So, atato brahma jignyasa. And what is that? Yatova imani mani jayanti. Yatova imani bhutani jayanti. That from which everything, jayanti, comes into existence or is born, yena jātāni jīvanti, by which everything is sustained, yat prayantya viṣaṅgaśanti, that by which everything is destroyed. So these two things go together. So janmādhyasya yataha, the first meaning of it, janmādhi asya, here asya, the first meaning based on the commentary of Vedanta Sutra, is asya here must mean of the manifested universes. Understanding that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Bhashanam Brahma Sutranam, as is stated in the Garuda Purana, that this Srimad Bhagavatam is the commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. So that this is the first way to asya. Although if the word asya simply means of this. So, if we take this to mean, that can also, here Srila Prabhupada has given the translation of asya as of the manifested universes, which fits with janma adi. But, if you take asya to mean something else, which it could mean many things, then the verse can be understood in different ways also. Because the whole verse can then something else. In this Srila Bhakti Stone Saraswati Thakur spoke on this verse for 30 days, and generally when he spoke he didn't speak for less than 2 hours at a time, and it said that he gave 30 different meanings of the verse. So it's possible, right? Now you may say this is by Sanskrit scholarship, that different meanings. Not really. It's really that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the it's not just a matter of scholarly, in a scholarly manner, screwing out all kinds of different meanings, but rather the absolute truth is described by Vyasadeva in the Shastra, and those who know, those who have the vision, they can see. It's not just a matter of poetics and linguistic analysis, but actually Vyasadeva has given everything there, and those who have the vision, they can, just like, I was giving that example, that in milk is ghee, but not everyone knows it. In fact, probably most of us, before we came to the Krishna consciousness, we never heard of ghee. Is it? We didn't know what is ghee. So, many people see milk, but not everyone knows that there is even such a thing as milk. Or even if you see it, doesn't necessarily mean you know how to make. Who knows how to make ghee? There are different methods. The method we use in modern ISKCON is not the traditional method used in India, in which you get the real flavor. Who knows that method? Anyone know? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. First you make the milk into yogurt, this is how Mother Yashoda makes it in Gopism. And then they churn that, and then the ghee comes out of that. It's not done. System. That's buttermilk. You heat the butter, and then first of all you make the butter, and then you. So anyway, I'm not discussing. It's not a cooking class. But the example has been given that those who know, they can understand that there is the essence within the milk, and they know how to extract that. So actually, Vyasadeva in Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna's this original Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he's presenting that, and Bhagavatam can be understood how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Krishna Tula Bhagavat Vibhu Sarvashroy. Prati shloke, prati akare, nana artako. That the Srimad Bhagavatam is non-different from Krishna. And it is just like Krishna. Everyone can take shelter of Srimad Bhagavatam. And get shelter from everyone. Just like, since I've come to Krishna, I've been hearing about the various difficulties that devotees are going through, even within ISKCON. There are various difficulties, which I suppose isn't surprising. But whatever anyone does to you or says to you, you can always take shelter of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's what Suhautra Maharaj was doing. He went through so many difficulties, and he was taking shelter of Srimad Bhagavatam. That was his shelter. So, Sarvashra. Sarva means all. Ashra means shelter. So, Srimad Bhagavatam gives shelter to everyone. They're willing to take shelter. And sarva means all, so we can take all people, and also in all respects. Sarva. Sarva means sarva lok, all people. Sarvata, in all respects. In all times, sarva kal, in all places, sarva desh. And Vibhu is powerful. Krishna is powerful. Srimad Bhagavatam is powerful. So his power, from our perspective, is manifest by his creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe. But there are various ways of understanding his greatness, because we're in this material world. We think that this creation of the material world is something very good. But at different levels we can understand his power. Only he has the shakti. Power means shakti. And the original shakti is Radharani. And there's no question of Radharani focusing on anyone else but Krishna. And only Krishna is powerful enough to accept that love, which is so powerful. So power is also there in love. And there's a different kind of power. It's not manifest as creating universes, destroying universes, holding up mountains. Atlas holds up the mountain with great difficulty, big strong muscles. Little Krishna pulling his mother's sari, little boy. That power, he's all powerful. And you may think, well, how is it that Krishna, he's just little boy pulling out his mother's sari, how is it that he's holding up all the universe? Atlas looks very strong, he's only holding up the earth. That's the Greek idea. He's struggling to hold up the earth. Krishna's holding the whole universe. Well, that shows how powerful he is. Because for Krishna, it's not a big thing. If he had to struggle to hold up the universe, what kind of God is that? Struggling. For him, holding up the universe is creating, maintaining, and destroying the universe is so insignificant, he's not even that much interested in it. He's interested in pulling his mother's sari. Well, feed him. He's interested in love. So, the crippled concept of God is of one who is very, we think of his power in terms of muscle power, or the power to control, the power to destroy, the power to punish. So that's all there in God, but he himself is more interested in Radharani, who's so powerful that she controls him. It's difficult to say who's more powerful. Radharani's more powerful, but then she's not different from him. She doesn't create, maintain, and destroy millions of universes. He does that. But then she controls him. So anyway, the point is that this word asya, of this, what is the this? It can be understood in various ways. The first understanding, because we are to inquire. So the first understanding is from our perspective, Shaka Chandra Nyan. From our perspective, we're in this material world. Shaka Chandra Nyai means the child is to show to the mother. Sorry, the mother is to show to the child what is the moon. Everything has to be taught to the young child. So the child knows the tree in the courtyard. He's familiar with that. So the mother points out that you see the tree between the branches. That round ball, that is the moon. So actually the moon is a far greater manifestation than the tree. Far more important than the tree. But because the child only has experience of that which is close to his immediate existence. Therefore, to indicate the moon, it is useful to indicate in relationship to the tree, although the moon is actually far beyond the tree and far greater. So in the same way, in the beginning, we may indicate that God means who is so great, he creates, maintains, and destroys the universe. But actually, that's not very important. For him, in his own point of view, he is much more interested in running in the forest of Vrindavan and being chastised by the Lord. That for him is more important. But if we say that without understanding his greatness, then we will simply think of him as an ordinary person. As Rama found out, he himself made that mistake. Anyway, we've discussed all these points previously. In the last 2 years, when we were discussing this verse, in the last two festivals, we got as far as itaratah. Itaratas chateshu. So now we have to discuss that. Let's go through. Now with Asya, you see. These points are so important that we can discuss again and again, even though we've discussed. The Janmadhya Sayataha we discussed 2 years ago. It's time to discuss again. If we go on like this, then we'll never get to the end of the verse. We'll be here. 50 years we'll be doing this festival. But there's no need to get to the end also, because even if there is no end actually, so even if you remain at the beginning is the end, because the beginning is Krishna, and the end is Krishna. And even when you reach the end of the Bhagavatam, what do? You go back to the beginning and start. So somehow or other we should remain discussing Krishna Katha. So Asya means of the manifested universes. Yataha, from whom? We were doing one. So from, again, Yataha, that will be Asya Yataha. So again, Yataha, if it's one of those words which can be understood in reference to various objects. Here the subject under discussion is Vasudeva. Alright, so I wanted to get up to Yataha. Anvayat, directly. Itarataha, indirectly. Cha and Arteshu, purposes. Abhignyaha, fully cognizant. Swarat, fully independent. Yeah, so now we'll move on to discuss abhigyaha, fully cognizant. Vasudev, the son of Vasudev, Krishna, the primeval Lord, knows everything, directly and indirectly. He knows everything. Now, this is accepted in all theistic religions. There's also atheistic religion, Buddhism, Jainism. There's semi-theistic religion, which is general Hinduism, Mayavad, polytheism, pantheism. What's the difference? Not much. Polytheism means to think there are many gods, and pantheism means to think that God is represented in everything. But the monotheistic tradition, means the Vaishnava tradition, and also some Shaiva traditions within Vedic culture, means worship of Lord Shiva. They take him to be supreme. So that could be considered monotheistic, although it's a mistake, because he's not a supreme. Shaktas, the worshippers of Shakti, they worship the material energy of Durga. They take her to be supreme. So that could be considered monotheistic in one sense. But the Semitic religions, that means Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, in terms of historical appearance, is the one, obviously. Although Islam claims it's to be the same as to go back to, like, the same as Judaism. although it really became defined by Hazrat Muhammad, peace be upon him. So, but anyway, the point here is that I'm making is that this fully cognizant, he knows everything. That is the basic, one of the conditions of the basic definitions of God, is that he is all powerful. That's omnipotent. You have a word in your language like that? Omnipotent. He is all-knowing, omniscient, and present everywhere. All-pervading, omnipresent. So this is one of the conditions of being God. If he doesn't know everything, he's not God. So this is a good challenge for the bogus gods, of which there are, you know, unending so-called avatars in India. So do they know everything? Are they all powerful? Are they present, all present? Now, that he knows everything, that it's very difficult for us to even imagine this, because we, as part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we all know many things. We couldn't even count all the things we know. I mean, apart from things that we kind of things that I consider knowledge, education, we learn at school, so many things. And we usually forget most of those things, although the knowledge we're told by the psychologists remains subliminally, at least. We don't fully forget it. Now, and then even after we leave school, we may go on reading books and magazines and seeing National Geographic Channel, Discovery Channel, History Channel, and we may learn more things by discussion with people. We learn things which are considered knowledge. Now, apart from that, Can you understand the English? You can follow. This is all right. It's not the easiest subject or words that are used here, because we're discussing the absolute truth, which is not in. It's not child's discussion. Now, Prahladma, children can also understand, but the topic is. Muhyanti yat suryaha, bewildering even to great demigods. So, it's not the easiest topic of discussion. Now, we're talking about knowledge. Knowledge, there's what we could call the academic knowledge, or the knowledge which someone who's considered educated, is considered part of culture, to be knowledgeable, to know many things, to know something about many things, and to be deeply knowledgeable about some things, or at least one subject, this is considered the sign of an educated or cultured person. Now, apart from that kind of knowledge, we all have an immense stockpile of knowledge that we receive at every moment. At every moment, we are receiving knowledge through the gyanendriyas, the knowledge-acquiring senses. At every moment, we see something, we hear something, smell, well, we're not cognizant of smelling all the time. Tasting is also something that it happens not all the time. Although in modern society it seems that they've invented that you can chew gum, smoke cigarettes, and always take snacks and tea 6 times a day or so. And in this way, always keep the tongue titillated. Chain smokers, they always have some taste on the tongue. So, but anyway, the gyanendriyas, they're always, and then the sense of touch. Again, we may not be cognizant of that, but the movement of the air, the touch of the clothes, is always there. So we're always receiving information, principally through the eyes and the ears. These two senses are constantly in touch with their tanmatras, the objects of the senses, which in this case, for the eyes means physical objects that are gross enough to be seen, and the ears means sound. So always we're receiving information, and that's also a kind of knowledge, which is, we may not, sometimes we're very, very conscious of something, to the extent that we become unconscious of other things which are actually, there may be something which is within our hearing range, but we don't hear it because we're so absorbed in something else. There's, the example is given in Shastra of a cobbler or a workman. He's working on the side of the road. That's quite common in India. People, they make something on the side of the road, and it's their shop also. So they're making some shoes, and someone may come and buy something, and then they stop making while they sell it. They may be making mats or something. They're making it, and it's a shop come workshop. So someone may be so absorbed in making the mat, the design of them, he's completely absorbed. So the king's party goes past with trumpets and gongs and bells, and he doesn't even notice because he's so absorbed. This example is given in Shastra of how one may forget the material world while being absorbed in Krishna consciousness. It's also an example of how, of certain levels of consciousness, how it's used in various ways. So anyway, the point, this is an example of being deeply absorbed in some activity. The conscious is completely absorbed. But all the time, there are various levels of conscious, just like I'm seeing all of you now, and there's some level of awareness. Here's someone I know, someone I don't know so well, someone's name I know, someone's name I don't know. And to some extent I'm aware. If I start to think about it, then I can see, oh, this person's wearing this kind of clothes and what. Sometimes devotees used to, I remember at Bhaktivedanta Manor where I joined in England, that one devotee, he used to make a quiz at breakfast time. Just after the class, we just had the deity greeting and the class, and then he'd go and ask the devotee, what color dress was Gokulananda wearing today? And see who was actually conscious. We're seeing the deities, and how much focused are we on seeing? Was he wearing today? Was he dressed today in with a mukut, a helmet, or a turban? And then you have to see who was. Which flute did he have? Because Krishna has different flutes. So which flute did they give him today? So how, there are levels of awareness, and just that we see, or I see, or I'm looking straight ahead now. In my neck at this angle, I can see Vidruti Prabhu's smiling face. But there's also the vision to a certain angle, and we don't see things much out of the angle. It's said that the subtle vision of the auras of people that is seen better through the side angle. So it said. You're not looking directly. I don't know. Because sometimes devotees said they saw like Prabhupada is shining like out of the sea from. They're just aware on the side of the. Out of the sea. So. Anyway, the point I'm making is that at every moment, just like I'm seeing, I may be looking at Vidruti Prabhu, but then I'm also aware of all of you, and you know I can see their different devotees and their names, and with seeing their face, I remember all the times. Automatically, without thinking about it very much, but if you say I know someone, it means that all different times I spoke with them, interacted with them. What other people have said about them, we have a whole impression about them. So at every moment we are taking in impressions, and that adds to our stockpile of knowledge. And it's all stockpiled and processed within the mind. So we have such a vast, and it's not only in this life, even from previous lives. So we have an incredible stockpile of knowledge that we ourselves are not aware of. We couldn't even possibly count or quantify how much we know. We know a lot. But on the other hand, we don't know very much at all. We don't know when we eat food how it's being digested. I mean, you can study biology or medicine or whatever to find out how the food is digested. But it's not like, you know, okay, now this gland, now tongue starts salivating. We don't, okay, now the digestive glands let forward your liquids. We don't, it just goes on automatically. So we don't even know how our food is digested. We don't know the different cells within our bodies. If you go for a medical checkup and you find out, oh, I got cancer. Awesome. Or, you know, I have anemia or something like this. Anemia? It's the same word in your language. What's the word? Yeah, it's the same word. So we're not aware of what's going on. On the one hand, we know so much. On the other hand, we know so little. And even a great scientist, he knows so much from our perspective, but then he knows so little from his own perspective, if he's honest. That however much you know about a subject, there's always a lot more to be known. So on one hand, we know very much. We know so much that we can't even imagine how much we know. And on the other hand, we know so little. And even the biggest brain only knows very little about some small area of knowledge. I mean, Einstein was brilliant, okay, relativity theory. But how much did Einstein know about botany? Probably not very much. Probably more than most of us, because, you know, he's a big brain and he was a scientist. How much did he know about... He's telling the word for botany, yeah. How much did he know about geriatric medicine? Probably didn't know very much at all. So, and there are so many areas of knowledge. How much did Einstein know about the history of Lika? How much does anyone know about the history of Lika? Maybe someone knows. Did anyone ever write a book on the history of Lika? Probably not. You did? Yeah.
There's a web page.
You see, he knows something which we didn't know. Now we learn something. And if we go to that website, then we'll learn something. It may be true or not true. Because it's probably written by a Croatian.
No, by a Serb.
Oh, by a Serb. Okay. If it was written by a Croatian, then the recent history would be presented quite differently. I remember at school, because I was at school in England, the history class, Napoleon was presented as a buffoon. Buffoon, you know, is like a clown figure. They showed cartoons from the English press at the time of Napoleon. But in France, they have a different perception. They think Napoleon was a great hero. So history means the biases of different people. So we're just discussing here a little about knowledge. What constitutes, what is the meaning of knowledge? It's totally beyond our scope of imagination how God, he will say God, because later we have to talk about Krishna. First of all, let's talk about God. What's the difference? Well, God is the official position of Krishna. God means the Janmadhyasya Yataha. He is the source of all emanations. He maintains everything. He destroys everything. Another quality being discussed now is that he is omniscient. Abhigya. He knows everything. So this is God. But beyond being that omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, Krishna is all loving. So he's beyond the definition of God, is the person Krishna. They're not different, but the person Krishna, and this is the wonderful presentation of Vyasadeva in Srimad Bhagavatam. This is what Krishna consciousness has to offer to the world of theism. People may say, why you must have come across this in your country? We say, well, why did you leave your own religion? What is there? Why, if you want to be religious, that's all right, but why didn't you stick to your own religion? Well, the answer is, there could be many answers to that question, but one is that the Semitic religions, they only teach about God, but they don't teach about Krishna. And actually, even about God, they don't teach very well at all. They really don't have much idea of how, just like Srila Prabhupada would say, that it's good to say that God is great, but it's not enough. You should know how He is great. So in Srimad Bhagavatam is described Bhagavat Tattva Vijnanam, scientific knowledge of of how God is God. And more than that, there is beyond his godness, who is he, his personality. Now, in the Semitic religions, they state that, well, there are some differences there. I'm not very sure about Judaism. But in Christianity, of course, Christianity, there are many different branches. But we can say, basically, that, well, there's a belief in God the Father. So Father means person, which is contested in Islam. They say, no, how can God be a person? But Srila Prabhupada was saying, well, how can he not be a person? If we're a person, then how? We came from him, or we're dependent on him. How can we have any facet that is not in him? And then in one sense, we're more than him. But the personality, what is the the Christian concept is bewildered about that. And therefore they wrongly ascribe, as is pointed out in Islam, they wrongly ascribe the godness to Jesus, because they have no idea of who he was pointing toward. They very wrongly made a very, very big mistake in saying that Jesus himself is directly God. So, who is God? That is described in detail in Srimad Bhagavatam. And in fact, not in any other literature. Vishnu Purana, to some extent. Yes, in Vishnu Purana also. The nature of God. But then Srimad Bhagavatam is the ultimate Shastra, because it describes the God in his fullness and beyond his godness, his personality, which is actually not different from his godness. But again, from our perspective, we think of God as simply omniscient. Well, first of all, we think of him as omnipotent. That's the first thing, all-powerful. Omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. But then, if at all we are to accept that he is a person, then he must be the supreme lover also. And that is missed all the way up to the Vaishnava Sampradayas. The Vaishnava Sampradayas, they accept his personality. And to a greater or lesser extent, they accept the sweetness of his personality. But the full-fledged understanding of the sweetness of his personality is it's given in Srimad Bhagavatam, but only revealed by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam can be fully understood through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, abhigya, here we're discussing the word abhigya. He is all knowing. He knows everything. He knows every atom. And he knows from the microcosm to the macrocosm, everything. Vedaham samatitani vartamanani charjuna bhavishyani cha bhutani mangtu vedana kaschana. He knows everything, past, present, and future. But him, no one knows. How can anyone know? When we don't even know how our food is digested, then how can we know he who knows everything? If you want to know a person, just to know a person, you can know in so many ways. You can know psychologically, you can analyze. You can analyze sociologically his role in society. You can analyze anatomically, anatomically, what kind of in Ayurveda you would say this person is pitta predominated or vata predominated or kapha predominated. And then there's kapha pitta, pitta kapha, vata pitta, like this, they're different. Vata kapha means the anatomy is mostly vata with some pitta also, like they're different. Then you can analyze someone astrologically. That's also there. And then you can analyze different people see in different ways. Educationally, what are his qualifications? In so many ways you can analyze people. A man may look at a woman and analyze in terms of sexual attraction. A lion may look at the same woman and analyze in terms of flavor, belly-filling ability. The man is very attracted to the woman. The lion is also attracted, but in a different way. So we have various... Knowledge mixes with desire, isn't it? A lion may look at the same woman and analyze in terms of flavor, belly-filling ability. The man is very attracted to the woman. The lion is also attracted, but in a different way. So we have various... Knowledge mixes with desire, isn't it? Just like a man sees the body of a woman and desire, he sees, you know, two legs, one face and everything else, but his knowledge mixes with desire. And the lion's knowledge also mixes with, sees the same thing, but has a different desire in relation to that. And the sadhu sees the same, but he sees this body is the receptacle of a spirit soul. So knowledge always mixes with desire and with judgment. Someone may say, so there's a body. Now, a Croatian sees a Serbian body and feels some enmity towards that. Although intrinsically there's a Croatian body and a Serbian body, and intrinsically there's no grounds for enmity, but because of identification with the body, I am a Croatian, we don't like Serbians, that is a Serbian. Or more seriously, not nowadays, you have to wait a little more time for it to start again, sometime again in future, unless we distribute a lot more books. There'll be again Serbo-Croatian misunderstanding. So this knowledge mixes, just like I was saying, Napoleon, the history of England is mixed with Napoleon from the English point of view, at least when I was at school. Now they're probably more fair. They became there, but he was presented as a buffoon. Whereas from the French point of view, Napoleon, great hero. So the same person, the same activities, but are seen from a different perspective due to perceived self-interest. I'm English, we're all English, And we don't like the French. The French are our enemies. So that's the perception. So knowledge, pure knowledge, there is no pure knowledge. It's always mixed with desire. Science, or actually any academic study, is supposed to be neutral, and especially science. Just like Prabhupada used to say that there's no, when he's saying, talking about God, there's not Indian God or Christian God. It's just like gold. You can't say gold is Indian gold or American gold. Gold has its own nature. It might be Indian gold in as much as it's presently in the possession. It's situated within India and it's in the possession of an Indian person. But by its nature, it's not Indian. It might have been dug out of a mine in India. But it's not gold. It's intrinsically gold. And it has the same intrinsic nature as gold dug out of a mine in Africa, which is where most of the gold in the world comes from these days. From South Africa. So, knowledge, actual knowledge, should be value neutral. 2 + 2 = 4. So, 2 + 2 = 4. It's not a matter of opinion, but what we call knowledge in this world is mixed with our value judgments based on our identification with the body, which is based on ignorance. So practically all the knowledge in this world is that's why all the knowledge in this world is ignorance, because it's based on the misunderstanding of who we are. So it seems like knowledge, but it's all ignorance. All the universities are teaching ignorance. You say, well, how is it ignorance? They're teaching mathematics, history, geography, so many things. But it's all based on the ignorance of the underlying Weltanschauung, worldview, is that we are the body, we are here to enjoy this body. Even in philosophy, they may discuss different philosophies, but in the philosophy class, but actually they can't get free from the many of the philosophies. Most of the philosophies don't even get to the point of neutrality. It's based on what is good for me, for my own sense gratification. And even if theoretically they try to show a neutral viewpoint of the world, they can't, because we are living beings, and we cannot. The fact that we are absorbing knowledge means that we have self-interest. We're conscious living beings and we have self-interest. And if we misidentify our self-interest as being separate from that of serving Krishna, then whatever else, whatever other knowledge we imbibe is going to be based on a misunderstanding. So everything that goes on in the name of knowledge in this world is actually ignorance. It's knowledge on the platform of ignorance, which comes, it's like multiplying any number by zero. What do you get? Zero. The result is 1 million raised to the power of 1 million, which is a pretty big number, times zero equals zero. So all the knowledge in this world without knowledge of Krishna is zero. Or worse. Because it takes us away from Krishna. So Krishna knows everything, and he knows everything that Einstein knew. Plus, all the problems that Einstein was trying to solve, and they're still trying to solve. Einstein When he died, there was, you know, there's the problems in science which are going on up to the present day, which Einstein couldn't solve, and still going on. But they didn't get past the resolving the conflicts between relativity theory and quantum theory, and it's still going on. So Krishna can resolve it, but probably Krishna knows everything, but from a completely different perspective. But he knows. He knows all the theories. He gives them the theories. When people dream up philosophies to deny God, where do they get the intelligence to do that from? From Krishna. When people know things and they misknow things, how is that coming? From Krishna. Everything comes from Krishna. All knowledge comes from Him. And even the misrepresentation of knowledge, which we consider to be knowledge, that also comes from Krishna. And all the conflicting theories, people argue, they come up with one theory, and someone argues against it and gives another theory, and both the theories are wrong, because they don't recognize Krishna. All that knowledge, or what is considered knowledge, comes from Krishna. But Krishna actually, apart from knowing all the wrong things that we all know, or we don't know, everything that we know or we consider that we know, Krishna knows, but he knows everything, but everything from the right perspective. He gives the wrong perspectives because we want to forget Him, but He also sees everything from the correct perspective, which is His perspective. So everyone says, I think. Philosophy means different thinkers. And they're all, I think. But when Krishna says, I think, that's a fact. He knows. What he knows is correct. So Krishna knows everything, and it's completely beyond our ability to even begin to understand how Krishna can know everything. To know, just like I many years ago on TV, I saw some TV program that two scientists of, I think it was Oxford University, they had spent 5 years studying 1 acre of woodland in England. And they were studying the ecosystem and how everything interacts with each other, and the growth of the trees, and I don't know what. But you could have 1,000 scientists studying the same subject for all their lives. You can never possibly come to the end. Even if you study one insect, you could have 100 of the biggest brains in the world. There's so much. How this insect reacts with other insects, its cellular system, the cells within its body, the atoms within it. To study one atom is the, there's no end to it. Because knowledge of anything is unlimited, and Krishna understands everything, microcosmically, how everything interacts with each other, macrocosmically. He knows and understands everything. And it's completely beyond our ability to even begin to understand that. But if we deny, if we say he doesn't know everything, then there's no God. If he's God, he must know everything, which means that he is beyond the scope of our understanding. Completely beyond the scope of our understanding. And yet, as Srimad Bhagavatam begins with telling us that God is abhigya, knowing everything, and goes on to describe Krishna running in the forest of Vrindavan, it requires an acharya to present these two points. Brahma was bewildered. Brahma says, I know God, Narayana. I can accept him as God. But Krishna, God, how can he be God? When he's just running around in the forest. So this is the ultimate theism, and theism beyond theism. Theism beyond, understanding God beyond his godness. And you want to say, well, how can there be anything beyond his godness? But theism means to accept God as a person. Mayavad is not theism, even though they may talk of God, but ultimately they deny his personality. So that is not theism. Because if you deny anything about him, then that he cannot have this aspect, then he's not complete. So he's not God. So his personality must be there. Again, in Islam, they deny the personality. They consider it blasphemy to mention the personality of God. But then they pray to him. Then how can you pray to a non-person? I don't know how they get around that one. So they don't get around it. It's a nonsensical proposition, actually. Don't say it in the presence of Muslims, because I've never met a Muslim who you can have a philosophical discussion with. They don't, blind faith. If you don't agree, then cut off your head or shoot you, whatever. Blow you up. So, become angry. It cannot be. We only accept. So, blind faith. It may seem that blind faith is required because God is so great. How can you understand him through knowledge when our ability to understand is so little? That is possible by the grace of God. Because we are also, as part and parcel of him, we're also knowledgeable living beings. We have knowledge, we have the ability to understand, but in a very small way. But then if our knowledge is not focused on him, then it must be focused on not him, and there is nothing but him. So not to be focused on him means maya, illusion. So our knowledge or the propensity, just like he knows everything because he's complete, and we know something because we are part and parcel of him, but we're not complete. So we can know something, but the propensity to know is there. And if the propensity is to know is not focused on him, then it must be focused on the consideration that there is anything but him, which is maya, because he is everything. So we can know him to some extent. And Bhagavatam teaches about him fully. That means as fully as we can understand. But to understand him fully is not possible. But at least we have to accept he is all-knowing. How he can know everything is beyond our ability to understand, because our ability to know is so limited. But at least we should accept that he knows everything. That is a basic principle of theism. Is there any question about this? It's a little heavy philosophical stuff. Not very heavy, actually. But it may seem that, well, why don't we just talk about Krishna and Vrindavan? Yes, we should talk about Krishna. Definitely, we must. But this, again, this basic understanding must be there. Otherwise, we'll make the same mistake as Lord Brahma made. We'll think that he isn't God, or we'll take it in a sentimental manner. So, Vyasadeva has presented Krishna in Bhagavatam, beginning from this. So he started from this. And those who are to approach Krishna, who is described in the Bhagavatam, especially in the 10th canto, they must begin here. And it's such a big subject that it seems even to or any subject, if we analyze, it's a big subject. We want to speak of the subject of God. It's like I was saying, to study one leaf, you could spend your whole life. So what to speak of Krishna? So we must understand this. We should study, understand. And not go beyond this, but taking this knowledge, which is possible to understand. Again, how we understand this knowledge is another point. It's not simply by an academic method. But taking this knowledge, then we go through the whole Bhagavatam and eventually time to come to the 10th canto. What's your question?
Actually, I want to know, in one sense we see that our acharyas and even great devotees very learned, especially
our parents. The level of learning in the modern age is much less. Things are going down fast. The level of learning of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarathakura's disciples was just far greater than the present disciple who follows. The average level was much greater than the present disciple who follows either in ISKCON or Gauriya Math. That's why sometimes devotees say about me, "Oi, he's a scholar." Or, when I know something a little about the level of scholarship, and I know for sure I'm not a scholar. Then
on other hand,
you know something now. Also, having associated with the last year, it's scholars. But even those scholars, you see, previously,
well, Sheshagiri Rao knows. He is really amazing.
Yeah. But then,
among them also, there is a classification. There, isn't
it? Yeah. Yeah, of course. The general level previously was so much higher. Who you think is very high, that might have been just been normal previously. And so, yeah, what's your question?
And on the other hand, actually what is the essence is to have bhakti.
Yeah.
And to have bhakti, to love Krishna.
Yeah.
How we can combine these two in practical life, because we would like to be learned, but it's not in our capacity.
None of the brains. It requires brains, a desire, and time also. I regret that I'd like to study a lot more, but then if you're going to travel and preach, then you don't have so much time for that. But ultimately we have to serve Krishna. Bhakti means service, not simply accumulating knowledge. But this knowledge is the knowledge by which, for one thing, is not different. The knowledge of Bhagavatam is not different from Krishna. So cultivating this knowledge in the mood of devotion, which is inculcated by the acharyas, that is also bhakti. No, it's not that. So, that's also one form of bhakti, to inculcate this knowledge. and take pleasure in discovering Krishna in Shastra. Well, that's one thing. And also for the benefit of human society, Vaishnava society, to guide devotees with this knowledge, because you can just chant and dance and serve and become very advanced. But the tendency is, among coming from the conditioned background, unless we hear and unless we're guided, then we'll tend to misunderstand. And we may be chanting and dancing and serving, but we may be doing it for our own. We have an idea of bhakti as being for our own enjoyment. Or we may be attracted by wrong philosophical understanding. So, unless one has very strong samskaras from previous life, a very strong purification from previous life, to only chant or to only serve without hearing and understanding philosophically will lead to deviation. And actually someone who's not interested in hearing, that in itself is a deviation, because hearing is an essential part of bhakti. So there may be different levels of hearing and scholarship, but every devotee has to understand the basic principle. Every devotee should understand Dasha Mu. I didn't talk about this one. The ten roots. Anaya Kaha Tattva. Knowledge is received from Shastra as delivered through the Parampara. Harim Iha Param. Hari, Krishna, is supreme. Sarva Shaktim is all powerful, which includes, actually, today we'll discuss omniscience. But Sarva Shakti means also that he's all-knowing, he's omnipresent. That includes, is included within Sarva Shakti. Rasabdhim, he's an ocean of rasa. Tadvibhinang shang sajiva, the jivas are his separated persons. Maya kavalitan, they can be captured by Maya, or tadvimuktat, or they can be in two states. One is captured by Maya or free from Maya. Achintya Veda Veda Sakalam Harim. Everything is inconceivably different from him and non-different from him. Sadhanam Shuddha Bhakti. The process of sadhana, the means to attain him, the means of attainment is the process of Shuddha Bhakti, pure devotional service. And Sadhyam Tatpriti. The goal of the sadhana is to attain love for him. So everyone should know these 10 points. If you're not clear on these points, then you can hear and chant and serve and be in mind. So not everyone may be a great scholar, but everyone should understand these points. And actually at initiation, everyone should understand. One should be initiated. One is initiated into this. One should understand.